Sammy Steele is a senior staff engineer at Figma and the tech lead for their databases team. She previously worked at Dropbox, where she built out their petabyte-scale metadata storage and search systems. Sammy recently published a blog called How Figma's Databases Teams Live to Tell the Scale. The blog went viral and made it to the top of Hacker News. We invited Sammy on the podcast to learn more, and she is our guest today. This episode of Software Engineering Daily is hosted by Sean Falconer. Check the show notes for more information on Sean's work and where to find him.
Sammy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Sean. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat. Let's start with some basics. Who are you? What do you do?
So, hi, I'm Sammy Steele, and I'm a senior staff engineer at Figma, where I'm the lead for our databases team. So, you know, in case people don't know what Figma is, it's really a collaborative suite of softwares that lets people go the whole way from like having an idea to designing that idea and turning it into like a fully realized product. And so we're probably most well known for Figma Design, which is where folks can build apps and websites and build all of the UI for that inside. But as an engineer, I really use FigJam, which is our whiteboarding kind of collaborative brainstorming tool all the time. I'm not a good Figma power user, but I love FigJam. So that's like what my company is. And as far as my team, our kind of secret sauce here at Figma is that we have this really collaborative real-time experience in the browser, which is where people can like comment on each other's docs and have kind of interactions with each other to build better things together. And you know, to power all that, you have to store a lot of state in databases, things like what users exist or like what files exist. And they have to be really fast, they have to be reliable, they have to be scalable. And so that's really my team's job, to make sure that our whole database platform like kind of just works seamlessly, and then the whole rest of the company can focus on building really cool products.
Yeah, I think it's a great overview. I've been a Figma user for a number of years now, and I think like one of the things that really blew me away about it is like there's certain applications that I think through like my 20 plus years of being in tech, like I couldn't have imagined transitioning from desktop applications to being like a web-based experience. And I think things like Photoshop, for example, is something like I started playing around with Photoshop as a kid in school in like the 90s. And like, I could not imagine that ever being essentially like something that you could do in the browser. And I think that's like really what blew me away the first time I used Figma. And then you tie that into the kind of like interactive stuff that you can do, the essentially collaborative elements, the comments that are like ways of, you know, that we would typically, you know, think about like modern systems like Google Docs or even collaborating on an open source project and bring that to design. It was just like mind blowing for me the first time I experienced it.
Yeah. I'm not a designer, but one of the things I really love about working at Figma is being at a company where so many people are really excited about our product. And it's just really cool as a back-end person to build something that like I'll be talking to people on the street and I mention I'm working at Figma and they're like, oh my God, I love Figma. So that's definitely, I feel very lucky there.
Well, so how did you end up there and sort of what made you want to join in the first place?
Yeah. So a little bit of my story. Before Figma, I had spent my whole career at Dropbox. Like both of my college internships were at Dropbox. And I was at Dropbox for 5 years as a full-timer. And so I spent all of that time on various back-end infra teams. But I think I was really lucky to be there at a time when the company was growing really fast and reaching like kind of petabyte, exabyte scale, but the engineering team was quite small. And so like I was part of a 5-person team that built a petabyte scale search system from scratch, because back in like 2012, 2015, Elasticsearch and OpenSearch didn't really scale. And so we had to build it ourselves. And then about 3 years before I joined Figma, I moved over to databases. And that was really the first time I fell in love with databases, because at Dropbox, we had built our own database system in-house. We actually had horizontally sharded on top of MySQL, but Dropbox was getting to the point where that sharded MySQL wasn't scaling to our size. Like we had a single customer so big that it was filling up a database. And so we ended up building our own key value store in-house and having to figure out how to migrate a petabyte of data. And that was about a 3-year project with just a phenomenal team, which actually that story has never really been told because all of us at the end of 3 years were so ready to do something different that a bunch of us kind of left Dropbox. And I was the first one to leave from my team because I had known for a while I wanted to try something different. And I wanted to go to a smaller company that was like just growing where I could kind of feel like I was having more of a say at like the organizational level of being able to change stuff. And so I really wanted to go somewhere where I knew I could build a really strong career. And it was 2022, like the height of the tech bubble. And I probably had conversations with like 50 startups and companies when I was trying to figure out where to go. I come from a VC family and I grew up in SF. And so I tend to naturally be a little bit skeptical of just, I've seen so many great people with good ideas whose companies don't work out. And so I basically narrowed it down to 3 companies that I felt like had really good like engineering culture and really good, interesting problems and actually like had a real good business fundamentals and revenue. And one of those 3 was Figma. And I interviewed at all of them and I just felt like Figma was the strongest of all of them. And so I'm so happy I came here because it's ended up being everything I wanted and a lot of things I wasn't even knowing to look for.
That's a very VC-like framework that you were using for evaluating companies. So maybe there's some influence there from your family members. I also made a transition in 2022. I think, you know, probably a lot of folks did. And it's true, like I probably talked to like 50 different companies during that process as well. And it is a lot of like, you know, sort of finding this like right combination of things that is a good fit for you and a good fit for your ambitions and what you want to do. So when you started at Figma, I want to talk a little bit about like the database systems there. Like what was sort of there as you stepped into their backend systems? Like what was the database set up at that time?
Yeah. Well, maybe first I'll give a little bit of color about like where Figma was as a company, because I think so much has changed over the last few years. And really the database story starts a few years before I got there. But when I joined, like infrastructure was 30 people. And since then we've like at least tripled, where I think we're a little over 100 folks now. And that growth has been really great. I mean, especially when so many people are laying off, I feel really lucky that we're still growing, but it has definitely changed a lot. And so like, I think I got to have a lot of say in like getting to do a lot of cross-functional, cross-organizational things. Like kind of a fun story from early in my days at Figma was that last year we were having our annual user conference, which is called Config. And so like Config happens every June. This year it's June 26th and 27th. And it is like by far the biggest day of the year for us. You know, all of our product launches are planned around that. And so last year's Config was so much bigger than anything we'd ever done before. It was like 7 times bigger than our previous Config event. And it was really exciting from a product perspective. You know, it was live at Moscone Center in SF with like 200,000 people joining in remote. But from an infra perspective, it was kind of terrifying because like suddenly we're launching this big conference. We're going to be doing live demos of the features and we want to GA all of these features from 0 to 100% in production, like during a keynote speech that our CEO is going to give. And so I was like, oh my God, like before we didn't plan around Config at all. We just kind of did things and it worked. But at this scale, we can't do that anymore. Like we need reliability plans. We need backup plans. We need to work. And so we ended up, you know, doing a lot of planning so that every product team had an infra partner and we could make sure things were reliable. And we all sat in a war room and thankfully it all went off without a hitch. So I think that's kind of like, there's just with all this exponential growth, even outside of databases, you end up in a lot of cool problems.
Yeah. So obviously like Figma's gone through like explosive growth over the last couple of years. So kind of going back to when you started there, like what were some of the problems from like an infrastructure and database standpoint that you were seeing from a campus,
totally
like, that was going to stop essentially the scale and growth that you wanted to achieve?
Okay. So really the problem started in 2020, about 2 years before I joined the team. Mm-hmm. And at that point, infra was something like 10 people and there were no teams. There was just infrastructure. And so they realized that their database was on the largest database that Amazon offered and that it was rapidly running out of space. And essentially, like, I think people have trouble realizing what that means sometimes. Like, if your database fills up and falls over and you can't just pick a bigger machine, like, your company is going to go down. The website will go hard down every day at peak traffic for like 5 or 6 hours until you fix the thing. And the fix, if it's gotten this bad, is probably like a month or two. So your company probably won't exist if you get to that point.
Yeah. So was this AWS RDS on running on like
24
instance or something like that?
Yeah. So we had managed to scale for like 10 years on a single RDS Postgres instance, which was a 24XL. And yeah, I think it's like kind of cool for all the startups out there. Like you can get a very long way and be very successful on pretty simple architectures. So I think that was a cool lesson from Figma, but clearly we had outgrown it at that point. And so what was a really small team of like four or five people, most of whom had never worked in databases before, basically had to figure out how to go from having like almost negative headroom on the database to like adding replicas, adding caching, and moving, you know, some really expensive workloads and re-architecting them just to buy some headroom. And so like I think it has been a four-year journey to get from having zero headroom to having what is essentially infinite headroom for us now. But along the way, there have been a lot of kind of scary challenges because I think people don't understand a lot of times. Like I'm a math major and I still sometimes have trouble wrapping my head around what exponential growth actually means. Because like if your database is close to falling over and you come up with an idea that's going to reduce CPU by 30% for 2 months of work, that sounds like really good, right? Like seems like I would take that trade-off. But the math comes out to, if you're growing like 2 or 3x every year, those 2 months of work actually only buy you a month of runway. And so you actually lost a month of runway on that project. And so the only way you can actually keep up with exponential growth is to come up with solutions that let you scale out exponentially as well. And that's where horizontal sharding came in.
Yeah. So these kind of like band-aid solutions that maybe were like a first course of action, like we'll add read replicas, separate writes and reads, we'll add caching. So maybe we don't have to hit the database quite as hard all the time. Like, you know, they're only going to get you so far, especially when you're talking about like this exponential growth, because at some point you need basically like a first principles approach to solving the problem that is probably fundamentally different than whatever you're doing today, because you just can't get those exponential gains otherwise.
Exactly. And so I think a lot of what the early team did was brutally prioritizing so that we could get the headroom to make the bigger foundational investments. Because like horizontal sharding, it still took our team 9 months to shard the first table. If we had 3 months of headroom or 6 months of headroom, that's a non-starter. You can't even do that. So I think it was a four-year journey because we kept having to buy, you know, now we have 6 months, now we have 9 months of runway, now we have a year of runway. And also, that's constantly changing because it's like when you're launching a product, there's a clear date. You're like April 15th, this product must be done. But when your database is trying to scale, there's no one telling you in exactly 3.5 months, my database will fall over. It's like you're growing at a rate, but someone launches a product and somehow you're growing like twice as fast now. And then maybe you don't grow for a month, but the growth spikes up. And so you're kind of racing against this clock, but you don't even actually know where the clock is.
Yeah, so I definitely want to get into the details of like the horizontal sharding. But before we get there, like as you started to sort of embark on this journey of trying to like fundamentally solve this problem at infinite scale, like how did you balance essentially like keeping things going? Like presumably, you know, you're still growing exponentially during this point where you're investing 9 months into trying to solve the actual problem, but you need to keep the business running and the database operational while also investing a lot of time into like solving the fundamental issue. So how did you kind of like balance the requirements of like things are on fire right now, but we also need to solve this long-term?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think part of it was that luckily by the time we got to actually doing horizontal sharding, we had about 6 months of runway and we had some ideas for how to extend that, like some things we could push off to other product teams. So I'd say that is actually my first advice is that the first things we looked for is how do we get other teams to help us out here? Because we were never going to ship this if it was just the databases team, which when I joined was still only 7 people. Like we couldn't have done this alone. A whole lot of other teams chipped in and even lent us resources. Like we had 2 people join our team to help out temporarily. And so I think you have to make a lot of hard trade-offs, but anything you can push to other teams when you're dealing with like an existential threat to the business, do that. And then really, it's a risk trade-off at the end of the day. Like we did defer reliability risks that we knew at some point we'd have to invest in, but we felt like scale was a bigger risk and probably we could wait a year to actually build those things. And so now I'm really happy we're getting to make a lot of reliability investments that we knew we wanted to make, but they just felt a lot less urgent than the burning fire of scaling.
Right. Ten seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your skills as a software developer, open source, the impact of AI?
How about your businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're delivering daily digests or serving sensational scoops, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for the $1 a month trial at shopify.com/sedaily, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/sedaily now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/sedaily.
So, you know, before you essentially arrived on the idea of doing horizontal sharding, like what were some of the like initial requirements that you thought through? Like what was ultimately like the goal state that you wanted to reach as you started to investigate like a solution to this problem?
Yeah, obviously we're not reinventing the wheel here. A lot of companies have horizontally sharded in some way or another before. And so I think what's fun about working in databases is that every company kind of brings its own set of unique challenges and requirements there. And so some of ours were, I think our top overall goal was minimize developer impact, because at the same time, Figma's product is taking off, and so we want to keep people excited about it, which means we want to keep building cool features people want to use. And so if we had stopped the whole company for 2 years to scale, we probably also wouldn't have been a successful business. So that was very top of mind. As an infra person, we always wanted to really maintain reliability and consistency, because those are things that our core product is built on top of. And we never wanted to get in a one-way migration. So like, you never want to end up on a new system where you have no way to get back to the old system, because inevitably there will be unknown unknowns, unexpected things will happen. And when that happens, you want to have a way to get back to the old system safely instead of just having your website down for hours until you fix it. So I think those were our three of our big core things, like minimize developer impact, avoid one-way migrations, and maintain reliability and consistency. Yeah, the other was probably play to our strengths. Like we knew things we were good at and weren't good at, and we really tried to take a pretty tactical approach for what we knew we could ship quickly and successfully.
Because you didn't want to do like a one-way migration, was that one of the reasons that you decided to stick with like Postgres, given all the, you know, distributed database options that are out there, like Spanner or Cockroach DB, and, you know, or even like a document store like a Mongo or a Dynamo?
Yeah, that was certainly a big part of it. You know, I think universal database scalability is probably, to me, the most unsolved problem in all of the cloud offerings. Like if you have a monitoring solution, most people are going to use a Datadog. If you have caching, like there's Redis, there's Memcached. Data analytics are mostly Snowflake these days. But I think like the best way to start a flame war with a whole bunch of infra engineers is to ask them to pick the best database, because everyone is going to have a completely different answer. And I think, you know, like you said, there's all of these options out there, which a lot of companies have really successfully made work at scale. But I guarantee you, for everyone that has worked, there's probably also a company that tried the exact same database and didn't have it work for their use case. And actually, this is kind of a fun story that didn't make it into our blog post. So we spent about 3 months exploring one of the database technologies that you'd mentioned. I'm not going to tell you which one. And there's nothing wrong with the database. Like, it's a great database, but it didn't work with our very specific performance and reliability needs. And so when we, you know, you have a couple months of headroom and you've just burned 3 months on what was basically throwaway work where you hit unknown unknowns, we were really, really risk averse after that. And that's a big reason of why we decided to build incrementally in-house versus trying yet another option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't want to burn another 3 months on something that you find out is not going to work for, you know, whatever your specific requirements are, versus at least you know the, like, you're familiar with the technologies that you're using. So then can you essentially, like, make them scalable by applying, like, tried and true approach of, like, horizontal sharding.
Totally. Plus, I think a lot of people really underestimate how many big challenges there are to adopting any new database technology. Like, first, the migration, which you kind of touched on. Like, if you want a reversible migration, that is going to be really hard. But even if you don't, just migrating consistently with low downtime, pretty challenging. And then you have all the performance characteristics, the workload things that are very specific to a specific database. And then you have team expertise, which my team had built years building around RDS. And so I think that, you know, when I was at Dropbox, we were performing a similar migration because we were moving from sharded MySQL to this new key value store we had built. And we spent probably an extra year, because Dropbox cared so much about consistency, trying to migrate in a way where we could guarantee 100% consistency by building atomic cross-shard transactions across two different databases, which was pretty cool, but also it took an extra year. You know, we certainly didn't have time to do something like that here at Figma.
Yeah, and like Dropbox, because of the nature of the business that they're primarily in of like file storage, it's going to yield different requirements at the database level than probably what you're dealing with at Figma.
Totally. And as far as team expertise goes, I think people kind of assume that if you have an open source or a managed product, like it just works. But at scale, that is pretty much never true. I think most people who have worked with these technologies at a big company know that you actually end up having to become a bit of an expert because you will hit weird edge cases that no one else has hit before. And like some examples of this, like my team personally has had to dig into the source code of PG Bouncer, which is an open source connection pooling framework on top of Postgres, and even into the Postgres source code to understand vacuuming problems that we were running into where CPU was spiking for us at the very end of our vacuums on our largest tables. Every single time CPU would hit 100% for about a minute. And this is happening 5 times a week. And we're trying to figure out why. And we ended up reading the vacuuming source code about 20 times before someone realized there's a special kind of query planning that only happens at the end of vacuuming, and that's 5 times more expensive than normal query planning. So, you know, weird things like that, you actually have to learn if you're operating any of these systems at scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's why you see a lot of these, like a Spanner or some of these other distributed systems, they come out of companies that are operating at massive scale, like, for example, Google. And because they had to solve, like, nothing off the shelf was going to solve this problem for them. So they had to essentially deploy their own internal resources to like solve it fundamentally for their specific use case. And then eventually they rolled that out as something that other people could use.
As a listener of Software Engineering Daily, you understand the impact of generative AI. On the podcast, we've covered many exciting aspects of Gen AI technologies, as well as the new vulnerabilities and risks they bring. HackerOne's AI Red Teaming addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses launching new AI deployments. Their approach involves stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. Within the HackerOne community, over 750 active hackers specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and safety testing. In a single recent engagement, a team of 18 HackerOne hackers quickly identified 26 valid findings within the initial 24 hours and accumulated over 100 valid findings in the two-week engagement. HackerOne offers strategic flexibility, rapid deployment, and a hybrid talent strategy. Learn more at hackerone.com/AI. That's HackerOne.com/AI.
So in terms of, you know, some of the challenges that you encountered as you started to build out like this horizontal sharding plan, like what were some of those initial like choke points that were hard or technical challenges that you had to kind of overcome?
Yeah, I think there were definitely a lot of them. I'd say two big ones were first figuring out what was the bare minimum feature set we had to build to ship our first table, because we had a very small team still. We had about 6 to 9 months of headroom, and we knew we needed to do something. And we also were afraid, you know, if our first table takes a year and then our next table takes another year, that's pretty risky for the company. So we wanted to pick the simplest possible feature set. And that meant picking a table that had a very simple data model. and let us shed a lot of features that we could then build, you know, 6 or 9 months down the road. So like the table we ended up picking was our user file recents table, which is where we store the data that is like when a user clicks on a file, we store like this is a recent file, and then people can go see what they've seen recently. And it was a good candidate for a few reasons. Like it was a very simple data model. So sharding by user ID was really easy. Basically every query included the user ID. And then it allowed us to like use a UUID as the primary key, which was made our avoided building a whole system we've had to since build to do general like global unique ID generation. And also at the end of the day, it was much easier to do a table that was obviously important. We don't ever want to lose any user data. But of all the tables at Figma, if, you know, a person is missing one row in their recent files, probably they're never going to notice. And so obviously we tried our very best and we were successful in not doing that, but it felt a lot less risky than picking like the files table.
Yeah, absolutely. People are going to notice when their design disappears, but maybe not so much like the recent file.
Exactly. And I think the other cool one was cross-shard transactions, mm-hmm. because this is something we touched very lightly on in the blog, but for a lot of companies with these new SQL options, they give you atomic cross-shard transactions by default. And so for folks who aren't familiar with cross-shard transactions, basically when you have one database, you get all this atomicity for free. And so if you're doing like a migration where you move a whole bunch of org data from one company to another inside Figma, you can do that all in a transaction and you're guaranteed all the data will just move from one company to another. But once you're moving across two different databases, you can imagine the writes could succeed on one and fail on the other, and you could actually lose data in the middle of that, which is absolutely terrifying. And so figuring out what to do for that was one of the first really early interesting challenges we had to do.
This episode of Software Engineering Daily is brought to you by Starburst. Struggling to deliver analytics at the speed your users want without your cost snowballing? For data engineers who battle to build and scale high-quality data pipelines, Starburst Data Lakehouse platform helps you deliver exceptional user experiences at petabyte scale without compromising on performance or cost. Trusted by the teams at Comcast, DoorDash, and MIT, Starburst delivers the adaptability and flexibility a Lakehouse ecosystem promises on an open architecture that supports Apache Iceberg, Delta Lake, and Hudi, so you always maintain ownership of your data. Want to see Starburst in action? Get started today with a free trial at starburst.io/SED.
So you chose essentially this table of recent files, and then the user ID that was the shard key that you used to shard the tables. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so then the reason transactions came in is because you'd think these would be a table where not a lot of interesting business logic happens, but actually this table gets updated in a number of kind of business critical other use cases tangentially. And so we went through a couple of different approaches here. Initially, our thinking was that we would actually let application teams deal with this because the two that we initially thought of were, one, have product teams rewrite their code so that it's robust to this, what we call a partial commit failure, where one database write succeeds and another fails. And that seemed like it would push the product problem off of the database's plate and let product teams solve it themselves. And the other, you know, kind of polar opposite would be to build atomic cross-shard transactions in-house, which we could have done. Like actually collectively on our team, we have implemented 4 or 5 different kinds of atomic cross-shard transactions because a bunch of people from my team built different kinds of it at Dropbox. So we could have taken that approach, but it felt like a lot of work. And so the product approach was our initial thinking. But actually what happened was we got a whole bunch of people in a room, and it was me and 2 senior staff engineers who are some of like the most senior product people at the company who have been there a long time and know the product inside and out, and like another infrastructure really senior engineer. And we were walking through this one example of one transaction whether it would be safe in this horizontally sharded world. And we talked for an hour, and we couldn't definitively say whether it was safe or not. And we were like, at that point, it was this aha moment of like, if the 4 of us can't figure out whether this is safe, there is no way we can expect every engineer at Figma to reason about this on a daily basis. And so we ended up going with a much more tactical approach where We basically classified all our transactions as low risk, medium risk, and high risk, where low risk is like, no one's really going to notice if this breaks. It's like a feature will look slightly glitchy for a second. To high risk would be like, it's a consistency problem. It's a security risk if this goes wrong. And so we really focused on the high risk ones and made sure those all had good fixes. And for low and medium risk, we did the math and we realized this is probably going to happen once or twice a year at our scale. And so we'll just monitor and we'll fix them as they come up. And that's worked out well for us. I think we've seen one in the past 18 months.
How did you classify those different transactions into those buckets?
Yeah. So we built this whole shadow framework as part of the horizontal sharding system, which has actually been really useful for product teams who want to analyze, you know, if they're preparing a table for horizontal sharding, what kind of work are they going to need to do? And so the way this works is we have our architecture, just very at a high level, is we have an application layer, and then we have this database proxy layer, which is a Go service that we actually built in-house. I'll talk more about that in a bit. And then we have our databases below that with their connection pooling layers. And so inside of this DB proxy service, we built out something called a shadow reads and writes, which would basically act as if a table was already horizontally sharded, even though it wasn't. And so we would shadow read traffic and write traffic, and we would log what would have happened if a table was sharded under a variety of different shard keys, like user ID or file key. And then we could send all of that data off to Snowflake for offline analysis. And we built out this really nice report and mode that it basically says, okay, you have 5 queries that are not compatible with horizontal sharding. You have 12 cross-shard transactions. You have 3 scatter gathers, which are expensive. You need to audit these. And once you fix all these things, your table is ready to be sharded.
Okay. And then in terms of the shadow setup, were you creating essentially like views on top of the tables to sort of mimic the idea of you're going to different databases as if it was a shard?
So that part is also, confusingly, is another kind of shadowing that we did. So we did create views. I'll talk about that in a second. But this specifically was not actually ever executing the queries. It was only at the query planner layer. So we have a query planner inside of DB proxy, and it would essentially fork off a process that would async query plan under these different topologies and then send that data. And so they never actually are executed. It's just logging what would have happened.
And then you're running that essentially in production against real traffic to see like what would be the consequences if we actually set up the sharding for this particular table.
Exactly. And so later on, when we were figuring out, are the queries correct, we did what you were just describing, where we actually would shadow live traffic through views to act as if we were already sharded. And that was once we'd picked a sharding key and done most of the work to already prepare a table for sharding. But this application readiness thing came very early in the process. Like, it's a lot of what helped us pick the right sharding key, because you could compare, you could say, if we use this sharding key, basically the table's already shardable. But if we pick this other one, we're going to have to do a ton of work to make it ready to be sharded.
Yeah, so that's a good way to have a pretty good sense for this project actually like working. Once you, it's not like you're just going to, hey, we spent all this time like setting up the shards, now we're going to roll it to production. Like, basically, this is a way for you to test the whole thing end to end and have a really, really good sense for whether it's going to work or not.
Yeah. And I think the other big advantage is we had to ask a lot of product teams to disrupt their roadmaps. Like, we tried to keep it to a minimum, but there was at least, you know, one team, especially at Figma, that owned a lot of our early mission critical tables. And they probably spent like 8 or 9 months just partnering with us on this stuff with at least 1 to 2 engineers. So for them, it was helpful to have an estimate of like, this is how much work it's going to be. And now, as we're going on asking a wider set of teams to do horizontal sharding on new tables, we can say to them, we expect this is only a week of work for your team. It's really easy. Or this is a deeper partnership. It's probably going to take a quarter for you guys to do this with us.
And can you walk me through the process of like what happens when I execute a query? Like, I'm going to write a query, and essentially, how does a query get processed, and then how does it essentially end up pulling data from, you know, one or multiple shards?
Yeah. So it starts the application layer, and Figma isn't a microservices, but it's also not a pure monolith. So we have, I'd say, about 10 different services that are talking to our database layer. And a lot of these power that real-time collaborative stuff I was talking about. So like LiveGraph is a Go service we have that powers our commenting systems, and it lets you basically live tail changes and subscribe to changes at the UI layer so that they get propagated in real time up to you. And so all of those clients, originally when we were vertically partitioning, which was our first step before horizontal sharding, would have to now know about the databases, and they would have to know to change and talk to a new database. And that was a lot of coordination and pretty painful. And so as part of this process, we ended up building out an intermediate layer, which we called dbproxy. And so basically you have the application layer up top, and all the like 10 different services all talk to dbproxy through a gRPC client. And then dbproxy is a Go service that does a whole lot of different things, but it can be thought of at least partly as a query engine, which will know how to parse a query and understand what is happening in that query and understand what tables and what shard keys are involved in the query, which then tells it where to route the data down to the different databases that lie below.
How does it know which part of the query is a shard key? Like, is it looking up in some, do you have to keep essentially a map of what the shard keys are and which tables are sharded?
Yeah, exactly. So that was an early challenge for us because initially we had this config file that before we horizontally sharded anything that just mapped from table to the physical database shard where that table lived. And it was causing us a lot of struggles because it would get out of sync or people would forget to update it. And so it was like probably the number one source of toil on my team for a while. And when we horizontally sharded, that was going to get a lot worse because shard splits would happen all the time. And so we decided to build this service called Topology, which is basically a config serving service that understands the state of the database and both the physical topology of what databases exist and then the logical topology of what shards exist and what tables and where these tables belong. Because we came up with this idea of what we call a colo. So a colo is short for a collocation, which is basically a set of tables that all share the same shard key. So like all the tables related to user data share user ID, or all the tables related to file data share file ID. And that's all contained in the topology.
And then does each shard, is there essentially read replicas as well as having right there? So you're being able to also share the load from a read-write perspective?
Yeah, and I think that's been a really important part of our scaling because as we scale more and more, one thing we've really done is push people towards most reads come from replicas by default. And that is huge from a reliability perspective because one, if our primary goes down, we're still serving reads. And two, we have two read replicas for every primary, and we hedge requests to both of those in every request. And so if one of those databases is down, we can actually still serve traffic. And so over the last year, actually, we had a big effort to rewrite all of our P0 most critical routes to only talk to replicas. You can't write from them, and you can't talk to primaries. And this was a pretty big effort from a whole bunch of heroic folks here at Figma. But as a result, if a primary goes down today, we can continue to serve all the most critical traffic at Figma.
And then in terms of like performance, is there any, because of this sort of like slightly more complex setup or maybe significantly more complex setup where you have to do this query planning, you have to figure out which shard to go to, like, is there any performance hit? Or also from like a cost perspective, is the infrastructure cost like higher than using like a simpler setup?
Yeah, that was definitely one of the early bottlenecks for dbproxy was performance. And so what we found is the most expensive step was the initial query parsing. So the client sends a SQL string in. It says like select star from table where like XYZ. And then we need to turn this into an AST or like an abstract syntax tree. And that's like a graph representation of that query that we can work with in code and understand what's happening. And that was the really expensive part of our process. And so we ended up adding a query cache in memory inside of dbproxy. So we generally have a much smaller set of query shapes because all our queries, you know, for security reasons are parameterized. And so even if the user ID in a query changes, what's being sent to dbproxy doesn't. And so we can reuse the same query plans over and over again. And that was a huge performance win for us.
And it, is the sharding setup elastic too, where as you like, if you outgrow essentially the number of shards that are available, are you automatically adding a new one for essentially growing beyond where you are now?
That would definitely be our North Star. It's mm-hmm. not where we're at today. So I think we've made a lot of really good progress over the last year in making a failover operation much more seamless. But even today, it's still maybe 2 weeks of work to do a sharding operation. And anytime you're having to move data from one database to another, you have consistency versus availability trade-offs, and you try to make the system as robust as possible to both, but you know, cap theorem, you're never going to win. And so there's always some slight risk that like you hit an unknown unknown and you end up getting stuck in a state where you're halfway failed over and not serving right traffic and you don't know, you know, how to recover. And so we spent a lot of time DRTing that and coming up with all these playbooks so we could have kind of worst case scenarios ahead of time, which has really paid off for us. But you know, one time we ran into an unknown unknown, actually a couple weeks ago, and my teammates got the site back within 2 minutes. They were like, okay, this failed unexpectedly. They ran 4 steps, and like a second later, the site was back up, which was really cool to see. But you can imagine that like that happening in the background with no humans involved is still kind of scary. And so hopefully we'll get there in the next year or two. But right now, we're mostly over allocating to where when we do a shard split, we expect it to get us 6 to 12 months of growth. And so to your point, we certainly are paying more, but that's a trade-off we're very happy to make because reliability and scale still matter more to us as a company than focusing on cost right now.
One of the other requirements that you mentioned at the beginning was lowering the impact that this would have on, like, from a developer experience perspective. So what impact did this actually have on the application developer? Like, do they need to understand what's happening at the database level, or is it sort of all transparent and handled for them?
Yeah. Well, any reshard operation that happens is fully transparent. So what we wanted to have is basically there's a one-time cost to sharding any table. Some work will be needed from the application team to understand where the bottlenecks are and fix things that aren't supported because we can't support 100% of functionality in a horizontally sharded world. So it's never going to be no work, but you should pay that cost once. And from there, it should kind of just work. And the database team should be the one scaling out behind the scenes and making sure that all of that happens transparently to users so they don't notice if we double or quadruple our capacity. And so that perspective is quite seamless. We also made some changes to our APIs to make it more obvious if people were doing things that are more expensive. Like there's this query called a scatter gather, which is where, you know, in a SQL query, if you include the shard key, we know exactly where to route it. We can parse that and we say, okay, the shard key is user ID, and the user ID is 10, and 10 belongs on shard 5. And so we know exactly where to route that query. But if you don't include the sharding key, we actually still wanted to support quite a few of those queries because we wanted to minimize rewriting. And so in that case, what we do is scatter the query out where we send it to all the database backends because we don't know where that data is. And then we gather up the results at the DB proxy layer, and DB proxy aggregates them back and sends them to the user. And you can imagine that gets quite complex if you're like doing a cross-shard join and now you're implementing almost like a Postgres query engine, which we did not want to do. So we don't support full SQL, but we support about 90%+ of the queries that our users are writing. And so that's probably the most visible thing is if someone tries to write a really complex query, they may have a test that fails and that test will say this query is no longer compatible.
In the case where someone is writing a query or there's an existing query that doesn't contain the shard key and you're doing this sort of like scatter method and aggregating results, are you like notifying or like logging that information somewhere so that someone can go and essentially figure out a way to improve the performance by including a shard key?
Yeah, definitely. The great thing at dbproxy is it lets us have a lot of observability into what queries are flowing through our system. And so I think that's been another huge win from controlling that proxy layer. Like we also have pgbouncer per database below that, but pgbouncer doesn't have a lot of observability by default. And so we add a lot of metrics at dbproxy, which we then expose back to our users. So that's one way. And also, we have actually updated some of our APIs, although this is still a bit work in progress, so that it shows up as a scatter gather. And you basically have to say, like, this is an allowed scatter gather. I know that I'm doing this. And we're still playing around with, like, is that useful or do people just ignore it? What is the ultimate, like, how do we push people to kind of by default just include the shard key without thinking about it? And I think that's a big unsolved problem that my team still wants to explore.
So once you got everything like ready, how did you go about actually migrating like the production data over to the horizontal shard setup? And were you able to do that without any downtime?
Yeah. So first, we had talked about we were shattering read traffic for quite a while before. And so we did that for about 3 months before we started serving any live production reads. But then before we even did a physical failover, One of the cool things about how we implemented sharding is we separated out the logical sharding layer from the physical sharding layer. And so what that means is the idea of a logical shard is that multiple logical shards could exist on the exact same physical shard, whereas physical shards always are represented by two different databases. And so we can, in essence, logically shard and pretend our data is sharded so that from the application perspective, it looks like everything is sharded, but we haven't moved any data around. All we've done is really flip a feature flag to maybe a 1% rollout. And so that made it a lot less risky to do this rollout because we could roll out to 1% or 10%. And then if we had problems, we would just roll back. And we did actually have problems at one point. Like we rolled out to 1% and it was fine. And we rolled out to 100% and it was also fine. And 5 minutes later, all of a sudden, we looked up and CPU was heading really high. And so we immediately rolled back and investigated. And we found out that we had basically run into some live lock connection pooling interactions from having like 4 times the load on a single physical database because we were acting as if it was sharded. So all those scatter gathers were being sent 4 times instead of 1 time. And that led to some weird behavior. So I think that was really cool that we actually like caught a bug and immediately rolled back and it didn't cause downtime, which was great to see. And so that's the logical layer. And then the physical failover only happens once we've been running in a logically failed overstate for like a month or two, and you're really confident everything there is working as expected.
And then what's the typical bottleneck? Like you mentioned a couple times, like CPU getting too high. Like, is it generally going to be CPU or is it, you know, memory or something else? Or does it depend essentially on the types of like queries and operations that you're running?
Yeah. It's been a bit of a moving target for sure. Early on when we just had one database, CPU was the limit. So for probably 2 or 3 years, all we were afraid of was CPU on our one biggest database because it would kept growing 3x every year. And then as we started getting ahead on that, we started running into different bottlenecks. So like last year was all about the write rate. Our write rate and our IOPS were actually starting to head towards the limits of what Amazon could support. And even before we hit a hard limit, we were actually hitting soft limits where there was reliability issues and more frequent outages that we were seeing because we were pushing the limits of what people typically do on RDS. And so, you know, we were trying to stay in a more conservative, like, let's not max out Postgres, let's not max out RDS. We think there's a bigger risk of SEVs if we run above a certain write rate. And so that was last year. And this year is actually about our biggest tables because now we have tables that are like 16 plus terabytes. And those run into issues with vacuuming because Postgres, kind of an odd design choice, this is one thing MySQL did a lot better, is that it has an integer transaction ID, which means eventually you're going to run out of transaction IDs. And if that happens, your whole database stops. And so the way you prevent that is you have to vacuum really regularly. And vacuuming is not just like a for fun cleanup operation to save space. It's an essential must do or your database dies. And vacuuming on large tables gets really expensive. So like those CPU spikes I mentioned earlier, those were our largest tables hitting vacuum limits. And so that's why we now want to shard our biggest tables as well.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about MySQL there. And, you know, obviously like there's some pros and cons to MySQL over Postgres, but which do you prefer working with, especially at scale, and why?
Yeah, I worked on a petabyte scale MySQL sharded system at Dropbox, and now I've worked at Postgres at Figma for 2 years. So I definitely have some hot takes. I think obviously both have their pros and cons. I think we ran into some pretty interesting consistency problems with MySQL at Dropbox. So Dropbox cared a lot about consistency, more than probably almost any company out there, because they cared so much about not corrupting data. And so in the project I was working on, if we had a consistency that we found, a single row, we would spend 6 to 12 weeks trying to debug that. And in the process of that, we actually found multiple bugs in the MySQL source code where MySQL was not returning consistent results. Like you would send a query and you would get back a result that was not the correct result, like using like read committed or whatever consistency you're relying on. And so like one crazy thing was a bug where there was a bug in ascending scans, but the implementation didn't have the same bug in descending scans. So the way we fixed it was flipping our entire data representation front to back so that we turned our most common operation, which was like a descending scan, into an ascending scan, and then the issue just went away. So I think I have some battle scars from that. I also think one thing Postgres does really well is that it's actually from version to version, very backwards compatible. So in MySQL, often a major version upgrade can be like a 2-year long project. And even a minor version upgrade can be scary. Whereas Postgres, like minor version upgrades, we're just kind of like, it's going to work. We're not even slightly worried. And major version upgrades, we can do those in like a month. And mostly it's just going to work because the open source folks are really thoughtful about making sure things don't change. So I'm a little more on the Postgres side, although maybe that's just because that's what I worked on today. And I mean, certainly MySQL has some nice features too that Postgres lacks. That transaction ID one I just complained about is probably the biggest.
And would there have been value in, you know, instead of using RDS directly, using like running Postgres yourself, or not necessarily yourself, but like essentially installed instance of it, so you could take advantage of some of the extension support that they have so that you can, you know, more directly extend it or modify it?
Yeah. I mean, I think Citus, I've heard really good things about that software. And so it was certainly a route we could have taken. I think at the time, because we had a team of 5 people and most of them didn't even know how databases worked at the time, it would have been a really big lift to manage our own databases. You know, at Dropbox, all of our databases were in-house. All of our hardware was in-house. We owned our own data centers. And I think coming from that background, I really would not underestimate the cost of having to manage your own databases. Like, you can do it, but you're now managing, like, is the database healthy? How do I promote it? How do I make sure there's really low downtime? And I think being managed let us operate with a much leaner team than we would have to be able to manage our own databases. Also, we've developed a really good relationship with the AWS folks. Like, we actually are on good speaking terms with members of the RDS team. I think at one point they gave us their phone number because they were like, you had a hard time reaching us during an issue. Like, we're just going to give this to you next time so you can text us if it's a real problem. So I think that relationship building also is a big reason why we've chosen to stay on, because we'd have to build that from scratch with a new company.
Yeah, I'm sure if you're storing like petabytes of data with RDS, then, you know, the tier of custom support that you're probably getting from them is maybe a little different and a little more bespoke than maybe the average customer. So as we start to wrap up, like, what advice would you give to some other, you know, tech teams out there that are facing like similar scaling issues with databases and are trying to figure out like, how do we actually, you know, fundamentally solve this problem? Like, where do we even get started?
Yeah, well, I think my first advice would be, don't just copy what we did. Like, think very carefully about what problem you're actually trying to solve. And also think really carefully about building in-house over buying. I know that sounds a little bit hypocritical considering that's what Figma did. But also, we were really, really aware when we were setting off down this approach that it was pretty ambitious. And it was very much like, because we were under tight time constraints, I think that if we were starting the project today with the experienced team we have and with the amount of headroom we have today, probably we would use a managed solution. And so, you know, I think it's really important to understand your own problem area and understand what are your bottlenecks? What are your workloads like? What are the biggest risks for you? And what kind of expertise does your team have? Because all of that is going to matter a lot more than just copying our approach. It worked for us, but it's not going to work for everyone.
Yeah. And then I guess, like, what's the future of this project? Like, you're going to continue, assume, to like choose other tables to shard, but like, what is the natural evolution of this beyond just doing the like rolling out horizontal sharding across the entire database?
Yeah. I think my team has a lot of cool challenges coming up. So certainly horizontal sharding will still be a big part of our next probably 2 years. I think that's how long it will take to do every table at Figma. And because of the incremental approach we built, you know, so far we haven't even tackled schema migrations. Like, we've only migrated tables where the schema basically never changes. So next 6 months, we need to build out horizontally sharded compatible schema changes. And similarly, like, we've gotten away with not having cross-shard transactions, but probably that won't last forever. We'll have to build that. So I think that will be a big part of 2 years. But also, it's really exciting that we're kind of moving on from horizontal sharding and from these scale problems. And we're getting to do things like actually tackle really important reliability risks for the company and build a much more robust future, or power a lot of new revenue, new generating features. You know, some of the things we're building at Config, my team has been really involved in, like, helping with pretty critical database layer stuff that will unblock that. And also the future of APIs. Like, I mentioned we've done some pretty tactical things to make it easier for folks to understand what horizontal sharding is. But one thing we're thinking about is, like, should we build an entirely new API layer, a new ORM layer? And what would that look like? Do we migrate the whole company? Do we just have a new use cases use it? So I think there's a lot of fun unknown unknowns, which is a big part of why I think databases is always throwing another problem at you. And that's one of the things I love about being on that team.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think, like, now that you're no longer sort of fighting these fires day to day, you've, like, earned the right in some fashion to solve some of these other problems. Like, you had to essentially figure out how to solve this so that you can move on to some of these other challenges, like reliability, and also make investments that go beyond, like, where you are as a company right now.
Exactly. And, like, I think as a tech lead, a big part of my job has been leading horizontal sharding for the last few years. But it's also things like being able to think of the long-term vision. So, you know, our 2 to 3 year roadmap are things that I now get to build out, and making sure that at any moment in time, we're actually prioritizing building the right things at the right level of quality with the right designs, and also helping grow all the engineers on my team, because I really want to leave Figma better than I found it. Not that I'm leaving anytime soon. I'm going to be here a long time, but I want to build the next generation of leaders so that, you know, when I joined the team, there was this engineer, Dylan, who had been leading the team for 2 years, and he'd kept the team together through all the really hard times. And he looked around as horizontal sharding was happening, and he saw that I had a potential opportunity to lead it, and that if he stayed on the team, he would probably just lead it, and it would be easy for him, and I wouldn't have a chance to grow. And so he ended up deciding to leave the team. He's still at the company. He's doing really cool things. But I always thought it was really wonderful that he looked around and said, I have a chance to help someone else grow. And that's what I really want to do for our team, is get the next generation of leaders at Figma.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, if you don't put responsibility in someone else's hands and give them a chance to succeed or fail, then you're never ever building essentially the next generation of leaders.
Exactly.
Well, Sammy, I want to thank you so much for being here. Also, for anyone that enjoyed this, like, definitely check out Sammy's awesome blog post, which is titled How Figma's Database Team Lived to Tell the Tale of Scale. It's really great. Lots of visuals explain, like, how they did all this stuff that goes into even more detail than we were able to get into today. We'll link that in the show notes, but thank you again for being here, and cheers.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Sean, and hope you all enjoyed it today. And my team is hiring, so if you're excited about these problems, please shoot me a note.
Awesome. Thank you.